Thank you for joining me. I am Brett Kelly, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or you can support the show on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. If you're interested in sporting one of your favorite fish species, please go check out our merch store over at Teespring, where you can browse through t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. Just look for the links to all those things that I described down in today's show notes. For today's episode, I am excited to introduce Rachel Brinkley. So Rachel grew up in the Treasure Valley of Idaho, and she received her bachelor's in ecology and conservation biology from Idaho State University. And she is graduating this semester with her master's in biology. Via active collaboration between Idaho State University and the Shoshone-Bannock tribes, her master's research was aimed at estimating the historical sockeye salmon escapement in the Sawtooth Valley lakes. In the summer months between weekend grinds to alpine lakes, she works in fisheries for the Forest Service in the Upper Salmon and Middle Fork Salmon watersheds. As a fisheries biologist in training, high mountain lake enthusiast, backpacker, field-going student, U.S. Forest Service employee, and fly fisherwoman, she works, recreates, and lives in Idaho's expansive public lands, spending more summer nights in the dirt than in her own home. Rachel is currently seeking permanent employment, but plans to pursue a career relating to the conservation and recovery of Idaho's salmon and steelhead. And without any further ado, welcome to the Fisheries Podcast, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so it's pretty clear from your bio that, you know, your life revolves around Idaho. Is it safe to assume that is where you're calling in from today?
Yeah, I just wrapped up my master's thesis at Idaho State University, and I'm still living and working in Pocatello, Idaho.
Very cool. Well, I'm not sure about you, but, you know, here towards northern Idaho, spring is definitely starting to kick in and full swing. Have you been able to get outside and enjoy it, or is the thesis edits keeping you at bay?
Finally, a little bit free of that. we've had periods of cold and warmer weather, but I've recently taken up rock climbing, which has been keeping me busy and outside while I patiently wait for things in the high country to thaw out a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's awesome that you picked up rock climbing. That was definitely my biggest outlet when I was pursuing my master's at Iowa State, actually. So that's kind of a cool thing. Do you mostly go indoors or outdoors?
Indoors for a while, but now that it's warming up, we've been moving outdoors.
Right on. That's cool. Well, I guess so for those of us that are maybe unfamiliar in the audience, could you explain where the Treasure Valley is?
Yeah. So the Treasure Valley is in western Idaho. It encompasses Boise and the surrounding areas.
Okay. So that's where you kind of cut your teeth on all things natural resources, I guess, huh?
Yes.
So there's actually a Trout Unlimited article that highlights your research. And in that, it describes a story in which you kind of attribute the start to your natural resources career. I thought it'd be kind of cool if you could maybe tell us that story or, you know, your own version of it.
Sure. Yeah, I was fortunate enough to have parents that spent time recreating outdoors. My first bath was in a cooler on the Salmon River, and my first birthday and my first birthday was spent on the shore of one of Idaho's historical sockeye salmon lakes. So in hindsight, my fate in natural resources was probably determined long before I realized.
Wow.
But in a previous interview with Trout Unlimited, I discussed some of my early encounters with Idaho salmon. And each fall, my parents would take us to look at Chinook spawning in the South Fork Salmon River. And while I vividly remember seeing them there, over time we stopped visiting as there were no fish one year, low returns the next year, and then another and another until we stopped talking about it. And these personal experiences with Idaho salmon I've certainly carried them with me through these early years in my career.
Wow. Yeah, I can't believe the amount of time that you probably spent in Idaho public land even yeah. before you were 10. Probably absolutely. Surpasses most people in their lifetime. So
pretty fortunate.
Yeah. So I guess more recently, you're finishing up your master's, as you described, at Idaho State, which focused on historical sockeye salmon populations in the Sawtooth Valley Lakes. So I guess for starters, could you maybe give us some background on, you know, the species itself and maybe why they are unique in Idaho?
So Idaho sockeye salmon, Snake River sockeye, have declined by over 99%. And they're actually one of the most depleted stocks of salmonids in the world. And they were listed as an endangered species in 1991. And like other species of Pacific salmon, they're considered a keystone species that push vast amounts of nutrients from the ocean to Idaho's fresh waters. And the loss of Snake River sockeye would mean the loss of the most powerful and unique sockeye population, as Snake River sockeye faced the longest migration with the greatest elevation gain of any sockeye population in the world.
Wow. So based on, you know, where they have to come from the Pacific Ocean, you know, like the Sawtooth Valley lakes, where geographically within Idaho are those lakes? And I guess you already described the Snake River, you know, historically, when would they be moving up these rivers to finish out their spawning cycle?
Yeah, so the Sawtooth Valley lakes are in central Idaho, and they make up some of Idaho's most iconic lakes, including Redfish Lake. All of the Sawtooth Valley lakes drain into the main Salmon River, which eventually drains into the Snake River, and it's all part of the Columbia River watershed. And Idaho sockeye currently, and probably historically, move from the Pacific Ocean back to Idaho beginning in about September and spawning in October.
Okay. So yeah, they can go, how many hundreds of miles is it, did you say? Or
I'm not exactly sure the exact mileage off the top of my head, but it's over 900 miles.
So yeah, they can span 900 miles, you know, historically in a pretty short amount of time. So
right. Yeah. And over those 900 miles, also gaining 6,500 feet in elevation, which is pretty substantial.
That would take me a year.
Yeah, longer than that for me.
that was just a ballpark estimate. I'm sure you're right for me as well. So I guess your research, the goal, if you know, if I'm capturing it correctly, was to estimate how large the historic runs were, or essentially how many fish were making it to the lake. I'm assuming that's correct, or
yeah. So the primary objective of our research. Was to estimate how many sockeye salmon used to use Idaho's lakes for spawning.
Okay. Given that these are research questions oriented around things that already happened and potentially in your case, decades or however many years you guys were looking into, what were some of the techniques that you used either in the field or in the lab to kind of collect and analyze this information that you were looking for?
Yeah. So we are estimating sockeye salmon abundance from about the early 1600s until currently. And the interest there, right, is that then you can have an idea of how many fish were there before any European settlement at all. We use lake sediment cores and stable isotopes. Generally speaking, with anadromy or migration from the ocean, salmon bring a heavy nitrogen isotope signature from the ocean back to freshwater lakes.
Okay.
And then when salmon die and decompose after spawning, this heavy ocean nitrogen signature is taken up by the lake food web, and eventually it sediments out to the bottom of the lake, and then this sediment builds up over time. So the sediment isotope signature that's measured at increasing depths in the lake sediment can help us determine the historical contribution of marine nutrients or the number of salmon over time.
Wow. So you're able to, you know, do sediment cores if I'm using the correct term there, and you're able to tell sort of like as you would age a tree, where you can actually see or estimate how many fish you would have thought were coming back to the lake annually. Is that?
Yes, that's exactly right. It is. It's not quite annually. It's about on 5-year time scales.
Okay.
But you're right. Looking back like you would in a tree ring just to assess how many fish have come back over time. Yeah.
That's incredible. So, I mean, is this something that you kind of like when you envisioned the project, did you design this study or was it something that, you know, obviously you're passionate about Idaho's salmon. And so I could see where if you were to come across something like this, it would be, you know, something that you would want to apply to. Or, you know, how did the opportunity sort of present itself to you?
Yeah, so I did my undergraduate at Idaho State University as well. I think that you mentioned that. And my advisor had used these same methods on lakes in Alaska. And he kind of already had been thinking about wanting to do this here in Idaho. And actually I was taking a undergrad seminar from him, and we could pick any research topic that we wanted to present on. And I chose sockeye salmon in Redfish Lake, and he thought, oh, this might be a good fit. And so I kind of fell into it that way, actually.
That's awesome. Yeah. I don't think anyone was probably that knew you anyways, was surprised when you chose a salmon related research project. I don't think.
I don't know. I don't think so.
So I guess, you know, we're all chomping at the bit here. Yeah. So what did you guys learn throughout the process? You know, without any spoilers from maybe some research that you have already, or, you know, want to publish, or, you know, your thesis that's coming out. Obviously we want people to, you know, dig into your work and not just take the Spark Notes version here.
Yeah.
But, you know, are there any results that you can share with our audience?
Yeah. So, well, backing up a little bit, having historical estimates from the early 1600s prior to European settlement, dams, irrigation diversions, et cetera, helps to negate against the effects of shifting baselines, which for those that aren't familiar, is a phenomenon that occurs in fisheries biology as the standards of what is considered a healthy fishery is lowered over decades of biologists. So I'm young in my fisheries career, right? I would see a couple hundred fish at Redfish Lake and think, this is great. And the recovery goal for Redfish Lake is 1,000 naturally returning spawners. And without an accurate baseline, marginal returns can start to look like recovery. For example, in 2012, a few hundred fish came back, like I mentioned, and the news released articles with headlines like the Northwest sees record returns of sockeye salmon.
I see.
And I think that the primary takeaways from our research are, first of all, that recovery goals are currently way below historical returns to the region, which we're estimating to be over 20,000 sockeye per year.
Wow.
And additionally, we're seeing some interesting temporal trends. For example, after the construction of a downstream dam in 1910, we observed dramatic declines in the input of marine derived nutrients. And after centuries of returns that demonstrated natural variation, our modeled outputs suggest that salmon declined by approximately 90% in the 5 years that followed the construction of that dam.
Wow.
And then lastly, our abundance estimates allow us to ask other questions, like what were the historical smolt to adult return rates or the historical contributions of marine-derived nutrients prior to habitat alteration or impaired river passage? So again, having these historical abundance estimates will allow us to ask further questions like that.
Very cool. Were you able to, you know, based on the results from the sediment core, how do you go about, I suppose, and maybe this is just something that I'd have to read into, like, obviously the thesis that you're writing, but how do you go from an amount of, you know, whatever it is, the isotope that you're looking for, mm-hmm. and say, like, this amount of X equals this amount of fish, if that makes sense, what I'm asking?
Yeah, totally. So it's a somewhat complicated mixing model that really is not actually that complicated. Essentially, we have a sediment isotope value. And then we did some biofilm analysis, water grab samples, some other water testing of current conditions, essentially with what we're considering to be zero fish, right? And then basically the only missing factor between, once you have the signature for the water and the signature for the sediment, the only thing that's missing from that equation is the historical contribution from fish.
There you go.
And so once you have those two things quantified, and then you have the isotope signature of a single sockeye, you can do that math actually pretty easily.
Awesome. Yeah, that, I get it now. So, you know, what did you personally take away now that you're wrapping up and moving on with, you know, looking at different avenues career-wise, what was something that you personally are taking away from your master's as maybe a piece of information that you learned, or like a character trait that you sort of learned about yourself, you know, something that you are gonna maybe look back on and say, you know, this is one of the things I'm taking from Idaho State that I'm going to keep with me into the future?
Yeah, I think that there's kind of two main things that I've taken away from my master's research. The first is, like I mentioned, this idea of shifting baselines, and that I'm a young biologist and I could come into a fishery, make, you know, some what are actually marginal improvements and feel like things have really improved when they're actually well worse off than the historical conditions.
Right.
And I think that's something that I will definitely think about in a future career. And I think that other than that, the thing that I've taken away is that, you know, short-term management or even legislative decisions can have really long-term impacts for ecosystems, and that these fisheries and ecosystems really will long outlast us, but the decisions right. that we're making do have long-term impacts.
Yeah. Well, those are great. And definitely, I thought it was cool that you shared your perspective about the shifting baselines, because I think, you know, I'm in a very similar boat where, you know, I just finished my master's in 2020. So, you know, I'm very young into my career as well. So that's something that I think I'll take away from this interview, actually, and kind of have that perspective in the back of my mind. So, I mean, just thinking about the lakes themselves, aside from the sockeye salmon for a bit, mm-hmm. obviously the species has declined dramatically, but the lack of those nutrients, typically in other parts of the Pacific Northwest, you could attribute that to like declined forest growth or something to that effect, I guess.
Yeah.
But like, have the lakes themselves changed in water chemistry or like the fish assemblage or anything like that? I mean, are there negative impacts, obviously more than to just the species, I guess, is what I was rambling to get to.
No worries. Yeah, I mean, the lakes are very oligotrophic. They're very nutrient poor. It's almost like diluted water.
Right.
And so we can, you know, assume that with over 20,000 fish a year, that historically was a large and important source of nutrients to these lakes. You know, we've kind of in the initial stages of this research in preliminary data have quantified that as being over 15% of the nutrient input. Which is pretty substantial to the nutrient dynamics of a system. And, you know, other than that, I'm sure that the fish assemblage has changed and that, you know, there's been some consequences of animals that historically fed on salmon. But it is, you know, those aren't necessarily things that we can determine from looking at the sediment cora like we can this input of marine nutrients.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So
I will say that you can do some other, you know, interesting things with sediment cores. Like there was a paper in 2007 by Daniel Selby, and he did some interesting things with pollen and phytoplankton to look at how plants and climate have changed over time, as well as how the phytoplankton assemblage has changed and potentially foraging then for sockeye salmon.
Oh, wow. That's neat. Yeah. So I guess wrapping it all up into mm-hmm. a scientific burrito that you can give to the audience, you know, what do you see as a potential future, like, implication of your research, or do you have sort of a perspective on, you know, we're at a couple hundred fish, how do we get to that recovery goal? And maybe that's outside of the scope
yeah.
of your research, but I'm sure obviously that this is super informational for those who, you know, they're going to use your results to try and get to that maybe baseline historically. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So as you and other listeners probably know, this research is kind of coming at a pivotal and important time in salmon research and recovery. As earlier this spring, Idaho's Representative Mike Simpson proposed a $34 billion plan to breach the lower Snake River dams in the name of salmon recovery. And an accurate baseline and historical projections are essential to a project such as that one and the restoration efforts that will follow. And additionally, a better understanding of the magnitude of decline in salmon and the effects that dams have had on their historical escapement highlight the importance of dramatic restoration efforts like that one. So I guess that I hope that this research is taken into consideration as not only management, but also legislative decisions are being made about the fate and future of Idaho salmon.
Right. Yeah. It's always good when research that's being done can back up sound science-based decisions. So that's really cool. Moving away from your research for just a little bit, obviously you are greater than your thesis work, no matter how awesome it is. I'm very jealous. You're also, I thought it was pretty cool, involved with TU and Costa's like Five Rivers Club while mm-hmm. you were at Idaho State. And I believe, if I'm correct, you were the founding member of your chapter.
Yeah.
That's cool. So I was one of the founding members of our club over at Clemson University. So I was like, oh, it's really cool to see how, you know, far and wide that program has kind of expanded, and that, you know, college students from coast to coast can benefit from this really, really generous and awesome program that they've, you know, started from just the ground up. Yeah. So I was just going to ask, you know, what was your experience with the Five Rivers Club?
Yeah. So founding a Five Rivers Club at Idaho State University was actually a pretty easy process because we had a really active American Fisheries Society on campus.
Oh, cool.
And so those two groups actually kind of function as one organization at Idaho State University. But the Five Rivers program has been immensely supportive of not only my research, but also of ISU's fisheries programs as a whole. And like I mentioned, it operates jointly with our American Fisheries Society chapter. And the combination of those groups has created a close-knit community of up-and-coming fisheries professionals who not only work together and help each other with field work, but also are a close group of friends who recreate together as well. And I think that the combination of those two groups has really aided in that.
Wow. Yeah. So I guess, you know, the fly fishing is just that good in Southern Idaho, obviously, that your that your AFS subunit is like, oh yeah, we all, you know, we're all into this Five Rivers thing.
Pretty much. Yeah.
That is super cool. Yeah. So at Clemson, you know, it was definitely, it stemmed from, we had a fly fishing club, and oddly enough, the overlap between our AFS subunit and the fly fishing club, I'd be willing to say off of memory from the years that I was there anyway, that I was the only member of both clubs. So it's super interesting see how, like, in different states, you know, you just have different sort of membership, yeah. I suppose.
You don't have those trophy trout waters.
Yeah. What? Come on. What's going on? Oh, that's really cool. And it's just awesome to see the Five Rivers Club still going, you know, stronger probably than it ever has. And it's good that you're able to, you know, involve them with your research too, because it's very much kind of seems like it aligns with, you know, their whole goal in the first place, which is like active conservation and having fun while doing it. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, cool. That sort of, you know, wraps up our formal part of the interview. And I guess now we'll move on to the final set questions that we ask each of our interviewees. And the first one tends to be most people's favorite, in my opinion, although it's hard to answer for some. What is your favorite fish? And I've been giving, and you can answer this into fish for and or to research. So, you know, some people have a favorite fish just because it exists and they think it's cool. And some people have a favorite fish because it's their favorite fish to like angle for. So I'll let you answer as you please.
So regardless of everything I've just said, no, I'd have to say that bull trout are my favorite fish species, in part due to experiences that I've had fishing for them. But I do, of course, have a soft spot for sockeye salmon.
Well, it's harder to fish for sockeye probably given where you are, I would assume.
Yeah. So. There is no sockeye fishing in Idaho.
Yeah. So that it makes sense. It makes sense. Well, that's cool. So I usually ask people, you know, what's your dream job or location? And you can definitely still answer the job part, but I don't know. Something about our interview today makes me want to assume that your favorite location or dream location would be in Idaho, right?
Yes. Central Idaho specifically.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think anyone that is familiar with the state would blame you. So I guess we'll switch it up if you'll allow me to. What would be a dream project of yours to work on if you had, you know, unlimited time or resources?
Unlimited resources. I would like to breach the Lower Snake River dams. And unlimited time and resources, I would certainly love to work on projects setting recovery of fisheries after the Lower Snake dams are removed.
Right. And so, you know, one thing that we ask each of our guests, and this is, I guess, the most philosophical question, is if there was one point or principle or, you know, one sort of lasting message that everyone that listened to this episode, they could take away, you could program that into everyone's head, what do you think that would be?
Yeah, I think, you know, in relation to my research, it would probably be that short-term management and legislative decisions can have long-lasting impacts. I think that also I would like to program into everyone's head the importance of thinking about upcoming generations of recreationalists, scientists, and everyone in between. We certainly want to continue to enjoy the same experiences and resources that folks have had for generations before us.
Absolutely. Yeah, we all, I think, got into this field at some base level to try and make things better, right? So I think that's an amazing thing to have programmed into people's heads. So thank you so much for being a guest on today's show, Rachel. If people wanted to connect with you online or maybe learn more about, you know, what you had going on at Idaho State or otherwise, you know, where can they find you? Do you have a website? Do you have a Twitter handle? Anything like that?
So I have been pretty good about discussing my research and my experience with Costa Five Rivers on Instagram. And my Instagram handle is RACHELBRINKLEY. So just Rachel Brinkley, all lowercase. Pretty
the OG Rachel Brinkley on Instagram.
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive.
I've not like Rachel Brinkley 42 something something, but anyway.
Yeah.
Also, if anyone has specific questions about my research or my thesis or something like that, you can reach me by email at rachelbrinkley@isu.edu. Again, all lowercase, super straightforward.
Perfect. Again, I'd like to just thank you for, you know, being a guest on today's show. I definitely learned a lot, and it makes me sort of pumped up to, you know, work on steelhead restoration up in northern Idaho after hearing all your insight from some salmon recovery efforts and research down in the lower part of the state. So yeah, it was great to talk to you.
Yeah, you too.
So thank you to everyone else for listening to this 118th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of me or any of the other co-hosts of the show, you can find us on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or send us an email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. Again, we hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head over to our Patreon page or our merch store at Teespring and support the podcast. We'd really appreciate it. I'm Brett Kelly, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, short-term management decisions have long-lasting effects on our natural resources, and those decisions should benefit all in the future.